Okay. And my name is Layla Ledbetter, and I'm with the PA History Society. Today is July 20th, 2011, and with me I have Barney McCullough. Hello, Barney.
Hello there, Layla. How are you?
Good. Okay, I'm going to get you started by asking you how you became interested in becoming a PA.
Well, I started off as I went to college at Memphis State, Tennessee, and I was going to be a physician, and I ran out of money. So I went to Charity Hospital in New Orleans to go to school for lab and x-ray. And I did lab and x-ray for 24 years. And at the time, I was working in Bluntstown, Florida, doing lab and x-ray and first assisting in surgery. And we had a x-ray tech and a radiologist come over to read our x-ray film. And the x-ray tech said, you know, have you heard about this program of PAs? I said, no, what about it? And he started telling me something about it, and then my hair started standing on end. And so I took the ball and I started calling Duke University, and they told me there was going to be a program at Alabama. Also, that their teachers were going to Alabama to start up a school, PA school, at the University of Alabama. So I got the addresses, and I made application at Duke University and also at Birmingham. And fortunately, I was accepted at both, but I was a single parent with four children, and I had to work. So I went to Alabama where I could come home on weekends because I was living in northern Florida, not too far from the Alabama line, but that was still about over 200 miles difference that I had to travel. And I made application at the University of Alabama, and I went up for an interview, and they accepted me. And fortunately, this became my life. Medicine. I've always been in medicine all my life. I was run over when I was 5 years old, and I had osteomyelitis. And back then, in 1935, there was no penicillin, no sulfa, no nothing. And all they could do is go in and scrape the bone and put maggots in and let them eat the decayed tissue and try to clean them out. Well, I spent most of my young life in the hospital, and this is why I became interested in medicine. But when I ran out of money, I changed directions, and this seemed to be another opportunity as I was at the top of the field in lab and x-ray and nowhere to go except down. So I was accepted, and we started the class there. The didactic portion was difficult. I was 40 years old, hadn't been in school for quite some time, had lost the touch of studying, but we did fine. My score was 74.5, that's what I graduated for, which is not bad for a 40-year-old man. At that time, I was the oldest PA in school. And when I left there, the University of Alabama, I graduated there in 1972. I was in the class of 1970, and there was 12 of us there originally, and some backed out, got a little too tough for them. Some of them had family problems. They had to go home. Six of us graduated. And I graduated a little earlier than the rest of them, as my last rotation was surgery. And I had done first assisting in surgery for 24 years. So they didn't require me to finish that. Dr. Frohmeyer was the director there at the program. Dean Meadows was the dean of the medical unit. So they sponsored it, and we almost ran out of money the first year. And
program did? Almost ran out?
Almost ran out of money, yes. That was the beginning of the first year program. Was federally funded, and by Dean Meadows really wasn't interested in the program anyway. So I came home to Florida and talked to our representative who lived just a few miles from me, and we did get over $100,000 at that time to finish the program.
State representative?
State representative of Florida,
wow.
Yes, in North Florida. I've forgotten his name right now. That's 40 years ago. But anyway, he did get some federal monies to help get started again. And I would come home on weekends and work at the hospital in Blountstown every weekend. I'd get home about 11, 12 o'clock at night and be at the hospital at 8 o'clock in the morning and work till 4, 4:30 in the afternoon and back Sunday morning and leave at 3:30 in the afternoon to go back to Birmingham. And that was every weekend, no vacation, no spare time. But it was the hardest thing I think I've ever done in my life, but probably the most appreciative thing that I've ever accomplished. And I'm very proud of that, but I did accomplish that with the struggles that we did have. My children were good. They didn't beg for me to come home and do things like children do. And I don't know what that I would have done had they not. I probably would have quit and come home and found another job. But I didn't. My first job after I graduated was in Brooksville, Florida. I was the first PA in Florida at that time. Nobody knew anything about physician assistants. And in fact, the doctor that I worked with, Gary Wilson, applied for. We talked a long time. And he says, well, says, you know, I bought this office from a doctor who went to direct the program at the University of Florida. And he's up there now, and this was in 1972. And said, what kind of salary do you demand? I said, I have no idea. He said, well, with $12,000 a year due? I said, I tell you what, I'll work for that the first year, and if I don't earn you more than $100,000 income, I'll turn around and walk off and won't say a word. So he went to the bank and borrowed $12,000 and put that in a special account. And that's where I drew months. Fortunately, I increased his income $125,000 the first year. Of course,
wow.
I worked like hell. I went to hospital every morning at 8 o'clock, went to the office at 9 o'clock, saw patients till noon, and then off from 12 to 1, had lunch, 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock, I was in the office. At 5, I left and went back to the hospital to do all the history and physicals of the patient we admitted that day. And after that, we'd go to the critical care unit, the ICU, which was new at that time. There weren't many of them around. And if we had patient in there, stay there most of the night and go home, take a shower and eat breakfast and go back and make rounds again. So these were the tough times, but it taught me a lot. I learned a lot doing this. It cost a lot for energy, time, family, but it was worth it.
How did people react to you? So when you so you were the first PA in Florida, and it sounds like you didn't have a super hard time finding a job, but how did the patients react to you?
Patients were leery at first, but, you know, most patients are trustful. Especially back then, anyone who knew anything about medicine was smarter than they were. But the problem that I had was with the nurses. They would not take any of my orders or anything. And one Sunday, I was making rounds at the hospital, and one of them from the obstetric department come up and says, we have a lady back there ready to deliver, and we can't find any of the obstetricians. Would you mind coming helping us? And I said, yes, and I went back and got there, and there was a breech birth. Well, it just scared the hell out of me. But anyway, I delivered and got a live delivery out of it, and mom and baby did well. Afterward, the nurses back there says, well, didn't want to scare you, but she delivered one breech here last year, and the baby died. So from then on, I had no problem with the nurses. They were the best friends I had. I think all they had to do is to know that somebody had good training and knew what they were talking about. And I delivered 82 on my OB rotation at the university. And I think my class is the only one that got obstetrical service. They discontinued it after I graduated, and I thank God that I was able to do that. It was one of the hardest rotations where we were on 24 off 12. That was tough. But there.
Do you remember? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, and that was tough, but it certainly was beneficial in the beginning here. Everywhere I've had to go, you have to prove yourself. The old saying, a reputation is earned and not given, and that is so true. And I have made a good reputation wherever I have been. And during my stay there at Brooksville, which was from 1971 to 1975, I did work. I see 15, 20, 25 patients per day. And that time, they were thinking about rural health clinics. They put up a pilot program in 1975, and the University of Southern Cal really put up the program. They did the pilot program, and I was one in that program that did participate. And in 1977, it became law, public law 95210. In 1975, I left Brooksville and went to Arkansas. And I was fortunate enough to meet the governor of Arkansas at that time. I'm sure you know who he is, Bill Clinton. Clinton was interested in getting some rural health clinics started in Arkansas, as Arkansas was second from the bottom in health care delivery in this country. And so we did rounds of the medical society and trying to get them to agree to some rural health clinics. Very difficult. I got one man, Dr. Bill Page, in Paragould, Arkansas, wanted to set up a rural health clinic. And we were ready to open, and the secretary of the Board of Medical Examiners called and said, Bill says, if you open up that clinic tomorrow, I'm going to pull your license. Says, you'll get them back, but it's going to take you a year to get them back. So we didn't open that clinic. And we could never convince the medical society in Arkansas that $32, which is a per diem, $32.10 is what rural health care clinics got. But that was an all-inclusive rate. Whatever we did, we got $32.10. No more, no less. They just couldn't understand why they were only getting $12 for an office call. But we did more than an office call. If I saw a patient with a broken leg, do an x-ray, do reduction, put a cast on, then follow him, but getting all of that would be $32.10. So I stayed in Arkansas and worked until 1977 when Public Law 92210 went into effect. And went with a doctor that was having difficulty with the medical board and started up a rural health clinic in Walker, Iowa. And Walker, Iowa is a town of 750 people. It has no pharmacy, no drugstore, no nurses, no nothing. But anyway, we set up a rural health clinic there. The doctor sold it to the town because he was having trouble with the medical board. The town bought it, and after 3 months, they became leery of the liability of a medical clinic, and they sold it to me. At that time, in 1977, interest was about 18-19%, but they sold it to me at 7.5%. So I bought the clinic, and it took me 3 months to break even. And we built a terrific program there. At the end of that, when I sold it in 1993, I was seeing over 8,000 patients a year.
Wow.
You can calculate that out. It was tough. The nearest hospital was 25 miles away. I had to put in a pharmacy in my office, and that's the way we did it. I had an x-ray in my office. I had a lab in my office. I did my own lab. I did my own bacteriology, so did my own EKGs. First, the doctor was there, but came down, and I paid him $20,000 for supervising to come down and sign my patient's charts. And second year, he says, well, I'm going up to $30,000. Doctor, I said, right now I'm breaking even. I can't afford it, so I got another one. Dr. Gallis came down from Cedar Rapids, and 25 miles away, his family practice, and such a superb, he was a saint. And we worked together for all those years. And one day, he says, Barney says, I hate to tell you this, but you do better practice than most of the physicians in Cedar Rapids. And that was a terrific compliment coming from him. In 1993, I retired and moved back to Florida. At one of my old patients from Brooksville, who I had treated, her and her two sons, called me and wanted to know if I would come over and help them in their clinic in Crystal River. And, you know, it's hard to tell somebody no. But I came over and I started working for her. And she was the administrator of MediCrest Family Practice in Crystal River. And we worked there from 1995 to 1992-99. And then I moved down and opened up my own clinic, another rural health clinic, Crystal Family Practice. And that was mine, and I run that until 2004, and I sold it and retired again. And I stayed retired. I played golf 6 times a week. I have 2 acres, which I took care of. I raise a big garden. In fact, last year I raised and shelled out and froze 20 pounds of southern peas.
Ooh,
which I'm still eating. I have some cooking right now, which I'll have for supper tonight. After I finish with you, Lila. That's, I mean, that's terrific. So it's not that I didn't have anything to do, but I missed my medical practice. And I guess God was good. A friend of mine who owned a clinic about 40 miles away had a heart attack. And he wanted to know if I would come help him with his clinic while he recovered from his heart attack. So I renewed my liability insurance right away and went up. And took me an hour and a half drive each way, which was 3 hours a day, and there 8 hours a day. And I did that for 3 months, and, of course, the bug got me again. And I finished it, and he got back to work. I came home, and, damn, I was in a restaurant one day, and I saw a doctor that I knew. He walked by. And I said, good morning. I said, how are you this morning, doctor? He says, fine. He says, aren't you a physician assistant? I said, yes. I said, I'm retired. He said, you're the man I'm looking for. And he came over to my table and were with me and my wife. And he talked to me. He said, please come see me Monday in the office and let's talk. And I did. And the next day I went back to work. And supposedly part-time. And I was there 2 weeks. And one Sunday, I was coming back from church, and I had a beep on my cell phone. I opened and listened to it. He says, Barney says, I'm on my way to the airport. I'm flying to Europe. Would you please take care of the clinic for me while I'm gone? Oh, I tell you what, I worked there for a year, and I quit. I retired again, and I stayed retired for about 2 months until I went back to work. I'm working part-time Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. But the fellow that's working Tuesday and Thursday, who is a part-time retired Army PA, is getting ready to go on vacation. So next week I start working 5 days a week. You know, I've enjoyed this all my life. Promised myself I would be fair and honest with every patient that I ever see, and I have kept that promise. And they have been good to me. I remember in Iowa one time, one Saturday I was working to build a deck on my house for Mother's Day for my wife. And somehow I tripped and fell through the floor joist and had a compounded comminuted fracture of my right leg. That's my leg that was operated on. My right leg is stiff and has been since I was a child. But anyway, I fell through there and it broke and the bone was sticking out. And there's nobody home but my 4-year-old son. And I called him up and I said, son, would you please come help me? And I pulled myself up through there and I asked him to get my foot. And he did and pulled it up. I said, now go in the house and get a bath towel. He did. And he come back, and I said, now, I want you to pull on my leg. He pulled as hard as he could, and I wrapped the towel around it to sort of absorb some of the bleeding. And after that, I said, son, go next door and tell Mr. Sam to come over for me. And he did, and he came over, and they called the ambulance. And I passed my wife and children, daughters, on the way to the hospital. They didn't know it, and I didn't know it. But anyway, that was a Saturday, and they operated on me that night and put me in cast, and Sunday I went home. Monday work, I went to the office in a wheelchair, and I saw 32 patients that day. It was a killer. But anyway, I owed my reputation to those people.
Mm-hmm.
And the only time I ever got to leave is when I had to leave and get my continued medical education, which was a requirement, which was 1 week a year. I'd always go to the conventions. That's where I could get my required amount at just one setting, wherever it happened to be. And that's where I would go because there's no one there after I left. So I owed this to the people, and the newspaper in the next town come over and did a story on it and published it. I don't have that one, but I do have some others. Some of the places that I've been, Bill Funnerfrock, who a long time ago was the head of the governmental affairs of the APA, and now he's head of the Rural Health Clinic Association, Federal Rural Health Clinic in Washington. Sam Walden is there in Rural Health Clinic, a section of health and welfare in Washington. Sam was one of the original things. He and I drew up a lot of the rules and regs for Rural Health Clinic. Also, the rules and reg, he called me about the rules and regulations for Rural Health Centers. And I talked to Sam about a month ago, and I imagine I've talked to Sam over 100 times over the years, but I've never met him. But yet, when I called and talked to him about 2 months ago, he says, "Barney, it's good to hear from you, but you know, this is my last year. I'm retiring." And Rural Health Clinic has really been my life. I've set up Rural Health Clinics from Iowa, Arkansas, Alaska, California, Florida, Georgia. Ed Friedman, who has a Rural Health Clinic in Iowa, helped him and his wife, who is also a PA, both the past presidents of the AAPA. I was on the governmental affairs in Iowa, the legislative committee. Ed and I were the legislative committee, and we had representatives and senators and mine or his house every weekend. That's why we got some of the laws passed, which were absolutely necessary. In Iowa, the medical society frankly didn't like physician assistants. The medical board did everything they could to drive us out. They drove a lot of us out. But a few of us were stubborn and stayed. And we finally got the law changed to where we were totally out of the hands of the medical board. Our own board was made up of three physician assistants, one MD who had to be a supervising physician, and a DO who had to be a supervising physician. And we answered to them only. So they even tried to close the schools at the University of Iowa and the school in Des Moines, osteopathic school. They had a PA program going there also. In fact, I used to go over to the osteopathic school and lecture the students over there about rural health clinics and the owning of your own clinic and being independent. And I think this interested a lot of them. I think that's one of the reasons so many rural health clinics have sprung up around the country. Of course, we had some intermediaries in the rural health clinics who didn't understand and gave us a lot of trouble. I remember one time in Iowa when I was running a rural health clinic, like my first rural health clinic, and Medicaid shorted me on my reimbursement. And I called them and I said, "Why are you shorting me?" She said, "Well, Governor Ray at that time has declared an austerity program and has cut reimbursement for Medicaid patients." I said, "Well," I said, "I'm a rural health clinic. I'm federally regulated." They said, "I'm sorry, the governor signed it. There's nothing we can do." I said, "Okay." So the next year they come up and they cut me another 15%. And I called them up and nowhere I can get there. I said, well, I can do something. And I called Sam up in Washington. And I told Sam what was going on. He says, they can't do that. I said, I know that, Sam. He says, well, says I can take care of that for you, Barney. And they cut off all federal funds to the state until they complied with the law. Now, that's an unusual situation. Also had some more problems with the Aetna, which was the intermediary for rural health clinics, east, correction, west of the Mississippi River. And they sent in my cost report. Every year you have to send in a cost report, and they determine your reimbursement by what your cost is. And they said, told me I was charging too much for my salary. That was not legal. And I said, I'm sorry, but it is. I said, I know what the rules are. And they wanted to know. They said, well, I said, I'm going to appeal this. And I did. And the appeal was held in Chicago in the office of Aetna. The judge was the vice president of Aetna, and the jury was made up of Aetna employees. And it was just me and my CPA. And the judge asked me, says, Mr. McCullough, says, do you feel comfortable with this appeal here? I said, no. I said, frankly, I feel like Daniel in the lion's den. Anyway, we discussed and fought back and forth all morning. Then they come up with something they did, and I said, that's wrong. That's not the law. And I said, it is. I said, Judge, I said, you go look this up right now. And he did, and he come back and said, oh, they're wrong. And I was cleared, and I won the case. And it's not many times that you will win an appeal with an intermediary. But I have fought all these years, just like I've fought everything with PAs. They've had a tough life and tough going. I think the road is a lot smoother now than it used to be. People know what a PA is, and there are a lot of rural health clinics across the country. All of them in my county you cannot have anymore. The health care to population ratio has reached above the poverty level, so we cannot have any more rural health clinics in this county unless somebody deletes one, then we can have another one. Other than that, they're all filled up. You have to go to the Census Bureau to find out what the census is and whether you qualify for a rural health clinic by population ratio to mental health care providers, primary health care providers. Also, there's another way is by a poverty level. If there's so many poverty levels, you can have a rural health clinic. But these are the only ways that you can have a rural health clinic. And this has pretty much been my life here in Crystal River now. I'm satisfied. I think I have made a difference. I hope that I've made a difference. And I hope to God that I am still making a difference. And I am very happy with my life and what I have accomplished. It has been tough, but I have worked hard at it. Do you have any further questions, Lila?
I have a couple, actually. I'm going to kind of backtrack a little bit. I was going to ask you if you remember who your instructors at Alabama were.
Alabama was Roger Lamb and, let's see, she came down from Duke University, and lovely lady. Her husband was a nephrologist. Andreoli.
Okay, Andreoli.
Yes, Kay Andreoli is her name. And her husband was Dr. Andreoli, a nephrologist. And I had done a lot of orthopedics prior to going to PA school. And she gave the first exam I took there in orthopedics. And I damn near flunked the exam. I said, Kay, you did it to me this time, but you'll never do it again. And she didn't. I never even come close to flunking an exam. I'm a B student. I've always been a B student. And I guess that's where I'm good. And I'm satisfied with that. So I have no qualms about it. But Kay was a wonderful lady and a wonderful instructor. Roger Lamb, he left Alabama, and actually he came down to Brooksville with me and worked with me for about a week to see how we were doing in private practice. And actually he started a clinic in Florida, a rural health clinic. So Roger learned, and actually he sold his clinic to one of the students that he instructed. And I haven't seen Roger in 30-some-odd years, but I still remember Roger. So Roger Lamb, Dr. Frohmeyer was the director of the program. And they almost converted that to a MedEx program.
Really? That's interesting.
Yes, there was a lot of talk there while we were there of converting it into a MedEx like they had in Washington, Washington State. Yes, there was talk, but it never happened. There was a surgical assistant program there at Birmingham, and he has put out a lot of surgical assistants, surgical PAs. So, but I don't think they are allowed to call themselves a PA. I think they're allowed to call them a surgical assistant. And he's a cardiac surgeon. Trying to think of his name. Can't remember it. You know, when you get my age, you do have senior. You'll learn.
I'm already doing it. So actually, and that was kind of, that's a good question, because I was going to ask you about people you met along the way that encouraged you or that were influential, or, you know, you remember a good story about someone like Kay Andreoli is like a big name in the PA.
You know, I talked to her about 20 years ago. I found out where she was in Texas, and I called her long distance to talk to her, and she remembered me. She remembered me.
That you weren't going to flunk another exam.
I told her, yeah. She remembered it, too.
That's wonderful.
I've often wondered, where is she now?
She's in California.
California.
And I think she got, and she's still doing really well. We actually put a biography of her up on the website, on the PA History website. But she's still going.
Oh, I'd love to talk to her. Would you be able to send me her phone number?
I absolutely can.
Okay.
While we're talking about exams, tell me about the exam and recertification process. How do you feel about that?
I think that I think it's overblown.
Mm-hmm.
I have taken recertification over 6 times. I have done better on each one that I took. And I have never, ever studied for a recertification. And I'm a B student. I'm not a real fast or classical learner. And I think that we do need to continue with continued medical education. I do on my own. I get more hours than they've ever requested.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's books, reading, or lectures, drug companies put on a lot. And, of course, they're biased, but I'm smart enough to take out what I need and what I can use. And I think the recertification is way overblown. Doctors don't get near as, have to take many as hours as we do. And I've often wondered why they do this when they don't do it themselves. I was one of the first PAs in the country, and like I was in the first class. I think there was 12 in my class. 6 of us graduated, and there was 2 in Duke's first class. I think it was 26 in their second class, and that's when we graduated with them. So I don't know, but I do know that I was the first, second national convention, which was held in San Antonio, Texas, and at Holiday Inn. And I think there was about, and that was 1973, and I think there was about 35 of us there at the Holiday Inn. They didn't have to make special reservations for us. And I just read in one of my journals, I think there was 8,000 at our last CME.
Yes.
So, you know, that's just a hell of a difference.
What did they talk about at the conference? Like, we know what they talk about now. What did they talk about then?
Back then, we talked about where we were working, how much money we made, and what we did. There were no specialties. We were all family practice. There were no specialty groups. Specialties didn't start till somewhere about in 80s. That's when they started specializing, and orthopedics was the first. In fact, I inspected the school at the University of Florida for AMA in 1973. That's when Dick Henry was the director there, and Dave Lewis was heading the program up. That was the first class of the Florida program. So, in fact, the director at the Florida program now came to Alabama as a student when I'm my second year. In fact, I interviewed him when he came there to apply as a student. So, and he's still at the director at the University of Florida program now. He left a few years ago to become a priest. And I didn't think that really suited him. He stayed away about 4 years and then came back to Florida and took over the program again. So he's a good guy, great guy. But these are some things that I've accomplished over the years, and I feel good about it.
Tell me if you could offer some advice to the PAs that are sort of coming into the profession now. What would you tell them?
Well, the PAs that are coming into the profession now are so different. When I applied in 1970, you had to have had a large background in medicine. Now, you can get out of college and go. They've got grad programs, they've got master programs, they've got PhD programs, and it's unbelievable. I don't really know where they really think they're going. Some of them think that a master's degree is what is really required, or a PhD. If I was going to be a PhD, I'd go to medical school. Why would I be a PA? You know, that doesn't make sense to me. When I was in Brooksville in 1975, I tried to get into medical school. I went to South America, to Guadalajara, Mexico, and tried Florida, tried Iowa, tried 3 or 4 schools. They all told me I was too old and said I wouldn't have enough years left to practice with what time they had to put into me and money. Well, I proved them wrong. I practiced over 40 years. So that doesn't hold true anymore. And right here in Crystal River, we have a graduate from the PA program in Florida who is a radiological oncologist now. And I refer to him, and he's a good friend. So, you know, a lot of the things we thought in the early days just aren't true. They started the surgical program in Washington. Two of my classmates went there, Mike Shear and Doug Condit. Doug Condit was a roommate of mine. Well, the doctor that taught him says, hell, I can teach a monkey to do surgery. He said that at one of our meetings there in Washington. So, you know, things have changed so rapidly. I've seen so many changes in medicine in the short time that I've been with it. It's just miraculous, the things that we can do now. Look at what an MRI, CAT scan. We never even thought of things those having. We had x-rays, and we had stereoscopic radiology. That was the big thing. Hell, nobody ever uses it anymore. I don't know. I don't know where it's going. I'm a diabetic. I do a lot of diabetic work. I take insulin. My hemoglobin A1C stays 6.2 to 6.4. I watch my diet very closely. I try to do that with patients. I'm not overweight. I weigh 168 pounds and 5'9". And I've worked hard all my life. I have never accepted any charity from anyone except when I was a child. And my mother and dad didn't have the money, and Shriners took care of me. I've had 50 surgeries on my right leg, not counting appendix or tonsils, but I mean, I've had my share, and I make no complaints. I do not complain about that at all. In fact, I think all of these things made me a better person. They told me I'd never walk again. Well, I proved them wrong. And I think them telling me what I couldn't do made me want to do it more. I'm Scotch-Irish, and I'm very proud of it. So, my dad was a hard worker, had an eighth grade education, and he impressed me a lot, probably more than anyone else, that tried to teach me to get an education, to do some things that he didn't do, well, he couldn't do. My grandfather and grandmother got smallpox and died, and left he and four brothers and sisters who were raised in an orphanage. And he ran away when he was 12 years old and worked with a contractor at that time, and that's what he did, is construction work. That's all he ever did. But he was a great man. I never heard him use profanity. So he was a good father, and I had two sisters and two brothers. My baby brother died at 18 months from pneumonia, but right now I'm the only one left. My sister died a year ago last April from cancer. I took her in, kept her in my house for 6 months and took care of her, and she died, and we took care of her. Last year, my father-in-law broke his leg. He's 89. And we moved he and her into the house. And he died in March of this year. And my mother-in-law is still here. In fact, my puppy dog is in the room with her right now. Anyway, this has been my life. I'm a regular guy. There's nothing special about me. I think the only thing special about me is my love of what I do and what I'm good at.
That sounds like, I mean, the first class at Alabama is a really big deal. And I think the little note I made was that you were one of the first PAs to own your own clinic in the U.S.
Yes, probably right. Probably one of the first. Because I opened it in 77. And that's when the law went into effect. So, yes. In fact, the first intermediary was Mutual of Omaha. It only had one. That took care of the whole country. But, you know, the government, everybody, every 4 or 6 years, they put out bids to who's going to do it. And so it changes. Or right now, they've got another one. It's not Aetna anymore. It was Tennessee last year. Now it's another intermediary taking care of it. But they switch. They put it up out for bid, and whoever comes in to the lowest bid gets it. That's not necessarily the best thing to do, but that's what they do. And each year when they first start, there's problems, but they iron out after about 2 years. You get everything straight. They withhold your money as long as they can, and it's all electronic. And if you don't file electronically, you don't get money. They hold your feet to the fire, just like Medicare is doing now with medical records. They pay us 2% more to do medical records, and it's fine. And they say it's going to be less paperwork, but I don't find it so. I think it's really more because of the copies and things that you have to do. Prescriptions you do electronically now, e-scripts. Patient never sees them. Sometimes they get lost. Last week, Public Pharmacy had an electronic failure. And, of course, all of them lost and had to be redone. But that's, I guess you call that progress, isn't it?
Actually, the drug prescription is a good point. So you were there during the fight to get PA's prescription privileges.
I certainly was. And
tell me about that.
Well, that's what I said. We had senators and representatives in the House. We made friends with them. Close friends. We fed them, we dined them, and we talked to them. We helped them along. And in Iowa, after we got our own board, we got a prescriptive practice where we could write for anything with the exception of Ritalin and Quaalude. We could write for morphine, Demerol, anything. Katie, bar the door. And but I don't know of anyone who ever abused that privilege. And I never could understand why we weren't allowed. If we wrote something wrong, we had our name to it, they had us cold. But yet, even somebody any off the street could come in and call a class 4, a class 5 drug into the pharmacy, and it's okay. But yet, I, as a physician assistant in Florida, cannot write a prescription or even send an e-script for a class 4 or class 5. I have talked and talked since I had been here, since it first started in 1972, that to get privilege for scripts. And I even talked to the Mixons, who are our people in legislature, and they said, well, they're still hostile to PAs writing controlled drugs. But yet, nurse practitioners, who are governed by a nurses association, they do what they feel. They're trying for independent practice, and they're fighting that tooth and nail. And I don't think that will happen in Florida. But Florida's groundbreaking for a lot of things, restaurants, hotels, whatever, foods, drugs, even the foreign medical graduates who come over here and can't pass the boards, they can come to Florida, and they can get as a PA, not a PAC, but they can practice as a physician assistant. They can get a license in Florida. No other state, but they can do that in Florida.
That's interesting.
It's more interesting, they can't even pass the PA boards.
Oh.
That's why they can't put a C after their PA.
Right.
Well, you tell the difference. If you see somebody with a PA, you know they're a foreign medical graduate and couldn't pass the medical boards. That's just the way it is. A lot of foreigners in Florida, and they had good representation in the legislature, and they let it happen. So,
did you do any work in Washington D.C. with all the legislation stuff, or did you do it mostly
only by phone?
In Iowa?
Only by phone. Yes, and conference with Sam Wallman. I talked to what's his name a couple of months ago, who's head of the Federal Office of Rural Health, Bill. See what I mean by senior moments. His name was Fenerfrock, Bill Fenerfrock. He's the head of the Federal Office of Rural Health now. So he also was very helpful with physician assistants back then when he was with the AAPA. And Bill Stanhope, I talked to him a couple of weeks ago. I think you know about that. I knew Bill many years ago. He was one of the first presidents of the AAPA. And Bill did a lot to help the PA Association. He was one of the old guards. He was one of the first grads of Duke also. You know, he and I about the same time graduating. Of course, I'm a lot older than Bill. I'm about 20 years older than Bill. But he did a lot of good. He got out of the PA and did other things other than what he was trained for. But I stayed with it. I've done nothing but family practice all these years. And I see them from one day old to one day before they die. I can't help them after that. Nothing I can do to help them after that, but no, they're good.
Do you have any stories of early on someone who, came in and you were trying to explain to them that you were a PA? Did anyone sort of fight you on it?
Did they fight me on it?
Yeah.
Oh, sure. Pharmacists.
Oh.
Sure. Why should you write prescriptions when we can't? You know, that's turf battles.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I first went into the hospitals, all of the doctors, what they do, I'd write orders or summary notes in the chart. As soon as I'd leave, they'd hurry up there and open up the chart and look and see what I did. In Arkansas, when I was working one time, the doctor that was supervising me had to go out of town for a day or so. And there was a National Guard who was on duty at night, and he got bit by something during the night. And anyway, he came in, and I called the health department to see what would be the recommended thing to do, since he didn't know what it was. And the health department recommended to give him the rabies treatment. And at that time, this was when the new treatment come in. It wasn't the long series of shots. It was a short series. I think it was three shots. And in other words, I wrote the order for this and procedure done exactly like the health department told me to do. And the Ohio staff doctor come back and says, well, I just canceled your orders on that patient. I said, what for? He says, well, we haven't heard any of those, done any of that procedure, and canceled it. I said, well, that's fine. I'm glad you did. I said, that relieves me all of the liability that goes with it. I said, I talked to the health department, and this is exactly what they told me to do, and that's what should be done. But I'm glad you did. Thank you, sir. And he went back, and he revisited the orders and reordered them. But that's fine. That's just some of the things. You know, they didn't know. In fact, he didn't know a thing about the new treatment for rabies. But all he had to do was call the health department. But, you know, some of them are too proud to do this, to say that they don't know. They let their ego get away from them. But most of them were good. I had one that I worked for in Arkansas for about 2 months. And he let me go. He says, I have to let you go. My partner is not going to take call if I keep you. He doesn't have any faith in you. Yeah, okay. That's fine. So it didn't take long to find another job. But all of these things existed because lack of knowledge. None of them knew, and that was in Arkansas, which they really didn't care. Anyway, that's the way it was. It was tough. It wasn't because I wasn't doing the work. It wasn't because I didn't have the knowledge to do the work. It's because this doctor associated, it really didn't take the time to find out what I could do and what I couldn't do, what I knew and what I didn't know. He just knew that I was doing his work, and I didn't go to the same school he did. It's an ego trip.
I'm surprised you didn't get discouraged.
No. I had I had four children.
Oh.
I now have seven. And 10 grandchildren. I have four girls and three boys. And I've been pretty busy in my life. I tell the young girls, don't get too close to me. So, I'm fertile. You didn't get it.
I didn't. I was like,
I have fun with my work. I have
it
fun
sounds
with
like it.
I remember one time I had a patient, an 82-year-old lady in the nursing home, and she had no family. No visitors ever come. And I would see her, I saw my nursing home patients once a month, and she was there depressed one day. And I went up to her, and I sided up to her real close, and I put my arm around her. And I looked in her eyes, and I said, honey, how about some sex? Her mouth dropped open, her eyes got big, then the biggest smile you ever saw came on her face. I made her day. I made her day. You know, with just one little statement. They wondered, does anybody care? And it helps when they find out somebody does care. It makes a difference. And I have made a difference. I know that I have. I've seen it on their faces. I make a difference every day. I have patients in my office that won't see the doctor for a damn thing. If I'm not there, they wait till I get back. They just won't do it. And it's great. It gives me a good feeling. It helps my ego. But I don't let my ego get in the way of health care. Now, what is best for the patient is great for me. That's what I want.
Well, we are winding up really close to an hour. Do you have anything else you want to say?
No, except that this has been my life. It has been my hope, my God-given privilege to do what I do. And I hope that God gives me more time. I told the doctor that I worked for, I said, if I die in the office, just call the ambulance, and I've had a good life, and I'd just as soon die here as at home. And as long as I'm physically and mentally able, I will continue to work and love my job and my patients.
That's a wonderful place to stop. So I'm going to go ahead and pause this right there.